Oh, I'll just check this, make sure we're in business. Okay, this is Monday, September the 24th, 2001. We're continuing the interview with Douglas Firsta now in Berkeley, California. All right, we're continuing here, and last time we talked about the committees, and especially the budget committee that you were on, but I believe you had some more things that you wanted to say about that, the budget committee work at Berkeley.
Yeah, during the first year or two that I was on the budget committee, the vice chancellor for academic affairs was Bob Koenig, Robert Koenig, professor of chemistry. And he was a man that is a man with real principles and straightforwardness, and it's kind of a pleasure to watch him act. But you might find interesting is Koenig is a younger brother of Phil Bradley's wife.
Kay Bradley.
Yeah, Kay Bradley. And first time I met Wayne Hazen, he told me that, well, you know, he was a classmate of Bob Koenig. So they both must have graduated in chemistry from here in 1940, I guess, with their BS. Hazen in the same class as Koenig. Mm-hmm. And it was Hazen told me that, by the way. Hey, I'd just like to also throw out something about what gives activities in the budget committee is that the University of California has a very rigid steps through all of the ranks. You know, assistant professor has you know, 4 steps of 2 years each, and associate professor normally I think three steps of 2 years each. I think they may have inserted a 4th step sometimes for people who are slow getting promoted. They throw in a 4th step. And likewise in the full professor range. And when I was on the budget committee, there were 3 steps in the full professor, and then maybe about 5% of the people would be over scale. And today there are now 9 steps in the full professor, and which takes them up pretty high, relatively high pay. Mm-hmm. And still, there will be apparently about 5% of the people are special salary or over scale. Mm-hmm. And going to the special salary, though, it looked like or treated it as a promotion and a fairly difficult step to achieve. But most other universities don't have such a system. You know, I remember hearing about cases in other major universities where assistant professors might be making as much as some full professors. In other words, the dean's discretion gives out the pay, and that and it almost means that everybody's negotiating their own pay in those kind of universities, and so I think this system that's here in UC as a whole is really very good, and I think quite unique. And so the budget committee gets involved every time there's, you know, merit increase going from one step to the next. So that is what adds a lot to the load.
Yes.
I'd also like just to make a comment about at times the pay has been politicized around here, and when one that I can still remember was when Reagan was governor, 1 year everybody in the state got a 5% pay increase, except teaching professors.
Uh-oh.
In the university. In other words, the secretaries here or the staff, anybody with a non-academic title got a pay raise and we didn't. That is really, the injection of politics into the...
And this was done by the government?
This was, this Reagan, probably those protests around 1970 over the Cambodia business. I think that was roughly when it was.
Did the governor have that kind of authority?
You wouldn't think he would, but I suppose he laid down the law. And he is a member of the Regents, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how often he attended. I know he attended when he fired Clark Kerr as president, which was when he was first governor. And but that's the whole system of having the Regents to be between the politics of the state and the university.
That is something that I just had a social affair over the weekend, got into a conversation with someone who was telling me that the University of California is unique in this, that it is owned by the Regents and not by the state, and that this is what makes it, in effect, more like a private institution, and this is how they are able to negotiate government contracts and have contracts with state and federal governments, because it is not technically owned by the state, but by the Regents.
I've never heard the word owned, but I think we're saying roughly the same thing. The Regents, if I write out a check to anything in UC, it goes to the Regents of the University, Regents, even for football tickets or...
And this keeps it at arm's length from the legislature,
right,
which is not true in other states, some other state universities.
Semi arm's length, because I told you about. But it does, And by the way, when Reagan became governor, Regents prior had 16-year terms. In other words, the length of term was so long that it would go beyond any given governor.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Reagan was behind it. It was reduced to 12 years, which is still a long time.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, during the FSM movement, all the problems around here, the chairman of the Board of Regents was our friend Don McLaughlin, who I think spent a lot of time wringing his hands over seeing what was happening to his old alma mater. A little bit, I didn't know him very well then, but I knew he was chairman.
Well, UC is also a land-grant institution.
Right. Yeah, it's...
So that gives it a federal charter,
doesn't it? Later on, shortly, I want to talk about what was a Mineral Institute program. And that was tied to a land-grant institution within the state. So I made good use of that.
Okay.
We'll get to that later.
Good.
Along this line, too, and you probably heard all about this from Maslach and other administration, that several generations ago, several key faculty objected to what the president of the university was doing, and they pushed through the situation where the Academic Senate of the University of California has major say in policy matters, etc. And I think there were six major professors who sort of had this revolt, one of them being a very famous geologist named Lawson that you've heard, and I imagine G.M. Lewis the physical chemist here. That, one last little thing I'd like to mention about committees, since committees are important on the academic senate, in the college, even in departments, it's interesting about service on committees. You know, some of the very active, high-level faculty around here who don't serve on any committees, and I know they get, some of it may have at times hurt them a bit, and I think that, you know, they're wrong about that. That people should do a certain amount of service, as I told you I did, and certain selected committees. Then again, there are other people who make a career out of it.
You have to strike a balance.
Oh yeah, this is right. In other words, university promotion, merit increase, you know, teaching, research, and service. And some people, you know, devote their total effort to service. I mean, to research.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's look at the second one.
Would you like to talk about the Miller Foundation?
Right.
So you were on the budget committee 66 to 69.
Yeah, right. And then
the Miller Foundation.
Yeah, here it's a UC Berkeley thing called the Miller Institute, and if I remember, it's Albert Sprague Miller Fund gave obviously a large endowment many years ago, and to establish what's called the Miller Institute, where a certain number of professors can be called Miller Institute professors, and there's maybe each year 6-8. Well, it's more than six, maybe 8 or 10, maybe 10 or 12, very high quality postdoctoral fellowships. And I remember when I was seeing one time, I looked at the list of Miller Fellows, and I saw that, for example, that Carl Sagan was a Miller Fellow about 1960, so he would have been here as a mm-hmm. on a postdoc under this program. Anyway, the Miller Foundation was, for the Miller professorships, an absolutely outstanding idea, which was that a person could apply, and if he was awarded a Miller professorship, it used to be there, most of them were for a year. Now, I think, because of high costs, a lot of times they're half a year. But the idea was that one's pay would come from the Miller Institute, and then your academic pay could be used to bring visitors here to work with you on your research. And that's the way it was when I had this in 1969. But from what I hear all the time today, is the dean takes the money, and it's often not a bit of it comes back to the department to hire a replacement teacher. I would think somebody could ought to press that one, but I know in the College of Engineering anyway, the dean uses that for funding other temporary people, where he thinks the greater need is, which, you know, I would think a violation of the idea.
So you were named a Miller professor.
Right. I had applied earlier, and I was very angry about it. I didn't get it. Some years earlier, and part of what distressed me was the department chairman let three applications go forward. So and today I don't know if one got it, two got it. I know three didn't, because I didn't, and I was, for several years not happy about that, getting turned down. You know, you just, the department shouldn't forward, you know, three applications and nominate, you ought to, you know, look ahead and let people do some planning. But that was a great year in that
You thought three was too many.
Well, applications.
Right.
As I say, I know I didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember if either of the other two did or not, because there's only maybe, I'll just pull out of the air, 8 or 10 of these in the whole campus per year, and at least then. And now I think it's, people kind of look at it a way to spend a year doing research, but in the day I had it, we had here 4 different high quality people, all foreigners, on my pay, which says our pay was a little better than them. And in the fall I had Klaus Scherner from the University of Karlsruhe. Technical University of Karlsruhe, and he's, as I've mentioned before, a big expert in fracture and breakage and comminution, and he taught our undergraduate course that we call particulate materials, and then I suggested that he have a seminar, a 2-unit seminar each week on fracture physics, and I said, oh, there'll be about maybe a half dozen people there, and Klaus told me when he entered the room for the first time there were 30 or 40 people sitting there, and he said, boy, was he taken aback, and he said he never worked so hard in all his life as preparing those fracture physics lectures that he gave. And of course, English was not his primary language. In fact, he some years ago told a funny story in this undergraduate class. He was lecturing, and apparently in the middle of the lecture slipped into German and didn't know it. And then at the end of the end of the hour, he said, well, are there any questions? I guess somebody told him, well, you know, you gave the lecture in German, so we don't know. Then what I did was I had, you know, a lot of research money then in those days, and so I also had each of these faculty spend another, we're on quarters, another quarter paid out of my research contract, so they were each year 6 months. And so in the winter, as Tom Healy...
Did you have sole jurisdiction over who was invited?
I did.
Uh-huh. It was your choice.
And then you had to write it. And then you had to write it up. Mm-hmm. You know, people approved it, because they would be, I think Schoenert and Healy were visiting associate professors, and maybe Levine Ottawa visiting professor. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Tom Healy from the University of Melbourne, who we've talked about earlier, came, spent 6 months, and he taught this graduate course that I called Surface Properties of Materials, and really participate a lot in our research. Then I invited also Ron Ottawill from the University of Bristol, and Ottawill is, I would think, today almost, or he's now retired, but, you know, was basically the worldwide, the top surface colloid chemist in the world, University of Bristol. And he was then a reader in physical chemistry at Bristol, and he taught a course that we called Applied Colloidal Phenomena. And after that, then I organized such a course and maybe taught every other year. And Otwell also dug in, worked very closely with the master's thesis of Osseo Sari, who I mentioned earlier, who was doing a master's. And Sam Levine, who was a professor or reader, I guess, in mathematics at University of Manchester, but did a lot of theory on the electrical double layer. He wrote me a theory of the electrical double layer, stuff I worked on for my own doctoral thesis. So Levine was here, and he gave he was here just probably the spring semester and gave a special seminar, two or three unit course on the theory of the double layer. Ottawa was teaching a regular course, but I had Levine do a seminar. So here we had these four people three of them were here 6 months, and Levine the 3 months. I'd just like to maybe mention, unrelated, anyway, that's the beauty of this Miller professorship, that it allows you to bring people that can work with you on your research and teach your classes. And as I say, I heard that's, the dean takes the money and uses it his way today, and that's too bad. Mm-hmm. But also, I've brought through the years some other visiting professors. Ernie Peters from the University of British Columbia, who I consider, he worked with me a little bit, a year and a half there at Union Carbide, and he, along with Milton Wadsworth at Utah, are really the two top people in the world in hydrometallurgy, leaching ores by acid or base, etc. And I think Peters was here, and I had him give a course on hydrometallurgy, I know Osseo Sari told me that, this course by Peters really directed him into hydromet, and I remember Ernie had maybe 15 people might have been in this class, he gave a term paper for the final. And I remember him telling me, he said, all of these term papers are better than any papers I've ever seen before. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, these are just better students than what we see up in British Columbia. Hmm. That's a direct quote from him. And I found that interesting. I forgot another person that some years later I invited here and gave a course on hydrometallurgy was Nat Arbiter. And this was probably half a dozen years later. And Arbiter's course would have been much more of an applied course than what Ernie Peters would have taught, but the students liked the material they got from Arbiter because he had a lot of plant practice, this sort of thing there. But then on another occasion.
Was Arbiter at Columbia at that time?
No, no, he was probably retired. He was living in Tucson.
Mm.
What he did is he came once a week and maybe gave his course in the, I'll pull it out here, if it's a two-unit course, he'd give the 2 hours of lecture, and maybe on some occasion he may have skipped a week and then was here a couple of days, and we somehow were able to arrange that you may have given two-hour lectures in a given week. However, you know, you got the full thing there. Another person that I invited was Professor Janusz Laskowski, who was a professor in mineral processing in the Technical University of Wrocław, and spelled like Wroclaw, in Poland. And this was 1982, and he had his visa, and he said they didn't know whether to give his wife and two kids visas or not, and that went back and forth. And finally, just the day before they were to depart, I guess the Poles gave them an exit visa. And, you know, they were here only a few weeks when it all hit the fan in Poland and the Russians came in. You know, this was the time of that Solidarity movement.
When was that?
1982, I think. Mm. And so he was here either half a year or longer. Maybe a year, and worked with us a lot on coal flotation, because he was an expert in coal. In fact, his father was a big man, also named Laskowski, director of the big coal research institute of Poland, Anyway, Laskowski, during his time here, got a job as professor up at the University of British Columbia, where he's been ever since. But he dug in and worked very extensively on our beginnings of coal research. And I have a few papers that we've written together on coal. A couple other people I'd just like to mention is Bob Hunter from the University of Sydney. Was here on a sabbatical, and he taught some of the lectures in my surface properties and materials course, and during which time he wrote a book called On Electrokinetics, and quite a few people seem to be able to dig in and write a book and put their nose to getting it written and get it done, and he did that while here. And finally, I'm very fortunate to get Professor Overbeek to spend a couple months here. I remember at the time he was 75, and I had to write a letter that he was in good health and all that to get through the budget committee approval. Not only did Overbeek give these superb lectures, but several hours a day he met with students from this department and other departments, and including several times by meeting with students. I mean, one-on-one discussing their research. I mean, just a truly remarkable individual. And by the way, he is now 90 this year, and Nat Arbiter also is 90 this year, both born 1911. I've talked to Nat on the telephone. He still sounds no different. I have not seen Overbeek for quite some time, but remarkable people.
Mm-hmm. Overbeek was at MIT with you.
He was at MIT the year, last year I was a grad student, which is what really got me in going in the direction of surface physical chemistry and at the extent I have. And actually it turns out that in future years, about every other year, Overbeek would spend half a year with a chemical engineering department at MIT. And there's a series of videos on surface and colloid chemistry that which are many hours of lectures by him that he made at that time. He was also enough so that he told me he collects American Social Security.
Oh, really?
So that tells you I've been over here at least in the jargon of Social Security, 40 quarters, the equivalent of 10 years.
But he resides still in England, at Cambridge?
In Holland, Netherlands.
Oh, Holland.
University of
Holland.
Utrecht. Mm-hmm. It was Ottawa, who's in England. But another thing that I found interesting with Overbeek, one time he told me when I saw him either in Holland or here, that he said, I feel much more comfortable talking to chemical engineers today than chemists, and he's a chemist. He's very fundamental surface colloid chemist, theorist, and experiment.
Mm-hmm. You had along the way a lot of interesting sabbaticals. We had just sort of mentioned in passing the one in London. Do you want to expand a little bit on that?
Right. The University of California has a very good sabbatical leave program. In fact, most other universities do not. In a lot of places, a faculty member, has to apply for a sabbatical, and they may be granted it. And a lot of times, people take sabbaticals, but they go somewhere and are paid. They might get a Fulbright or something and go and give lectures somewhere else. I don't quite call that a sabbatical. I mean, I never got paid for doing anything other than explain something shortly. I looked at a sabbatical as an opportunity to learn something more and maybe an opportunity to get away from Berkeley and an opportunity to live somewhere else. And so the first one, we went to England at 1966, 6 months, January to end of June.
Your university pay continues.
Let me back all the way up. When the first year I was here.
Okay. Now, the first year that you were here was 59.
Right. Jack Washburn was on sabbatical for the year in Cambridge, and when he got back, he told me, a year is too long to be away. Your research gets out of control, and the financing, everything else. And he thought, if one takes a sabbatical, I'd be happy. So I never forgot that, and I aimed my sabbaticals always at a half year. Mm-hmm. The UC system was you could take, and they slightly altered these. After 6 years, you could have one semester full pay, or two semesters, maybe say half pay. So somebody could go away half pay and maybe augmented in some other way. Maybe that's why sometimes people went somewhere and did some teaching, or you could also up your pay to full pay out of research contracts if that was approved by the agency. So in my case, we were half a year, and it was know, full pay. So wherever I went, I was not under obligation. So the first year, I arranged to go to Imperial College and the Royal School of Mines in London, and
you took Peggy and the three children.
Oh yeah, and we did, and when we got there, I forget the word the Brits use for state agent, for renting, a state agent.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked at, you know, there are only 2-3 places we could rent and that were, you know, not way out or something. And so we had a whole house about 2 blocks from Notting Hill Gate, and out the back side of our house was Portobello Road. Have you ever been on the antique road?
The antique shop.
So we were on Kensington Park Road that went parallel to Portobello. So you can see, in the spring, I could just walk across Kensington Gardens to Imperial College, which is right behind Royal Albert Hall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just the physical location. And
wonderful.
We put our two, Steve was only 2 and a half when we went there, and Lucy was 7 and Sarah became 5, and they both went to a very good school just a few blocks away, called Fox School. For some reason I remember that. Fox School, just the name of it.
Sounds closer.
Was a state school, and it was, but it was very, very good, and people liked to get their kids there. So here, as non-residents, we were able to get our two kids in there. And so it was just a few blocks of a walk that Peg would walk up there with them. Almost every day, here I was on sabbatical, and I was probably over there at Imperial College more than the faculty.
What were you doing?
A lot of writing and discussion, reading. I was really writing papers related to Berkeley work, in actuality.
Mm-hmm.
But also talking to the people. The department, which was now Royal School of Mines, was called Mineral Technology Department, which is the same as the name of this department way back then. And the British system has one professor, who was somebody named Marston Fleming, a Canadian, but he was more British than the Brits, and then they have a typical system will have 1 or 2 readers, which are equal to professors in this country, and then maybe a few senior lecturers and a few lecturers. So there's this sort of hierarchy of about 9 lecturers, I think 2 readers, 1 professor, and the professor is the head and titular head and really the head. And one day my friend Tom Malloy just came to London, and he called up Fleming, and his secretary answered, and he said, "I'd like to speak to Dr. Fleming." The secretary said, "Sir, to you, Professor Fleming." Anyway, the reader was J.A. Kitchener, and Kitchener at the time, I think, was probably the foremost surface chemist of England in 66, and he was in that department, did a lot of surface chemistry relating to wetting behavior, flotation, etc. And then another name that I remember was Henry Cohen, who taught things like electrical separation, magnetic separation. Cohen was a successor to Fleming when Fleming retired. And then my first roommate from MIT grad house, Olaf Melgren, was a lecturer there. And Olaf was there many years on the faculty. Good man, did a lot of nice research on flotation thermodynamics, this sort of thing. And Melgren, I may have mentioned, was a Norwegian, and he came from Hauge E. Delane. Hauge, H-A-U-G-E, and D hyphen, or apostrophe, no, Delane, maybe Hauge E, I, little I, then Delane, D-E-L-A-N-E. And there was a large ilmenite mine there, huge mine. I mean, this is where the town he came from, I mean village, really village. And the mine was, company was called Titania. And Olaf went up there consulting a lot, I think maybe most of each summer on the research. And they came up with a flotation procedure to concentrate the ilmenite that used a lot of oil, fuel oil. And by that I mean maybe 10, 20 pounds per ton of ore. That's a lot of oil. And by the way, years later we visited Olaf in Hauge, my one and only trip into Norway, and we visited the mine and so on. And we went out in a boat in a fjord right there, and he was doing sampling, you know, with the water. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, they were dumping the tailings from the mill into the fjord. Mm. And the fishermen were complaining about the oil was making the fish taste, fuel oil taste. Mm-hmm. So maybe some year or two later, I ran into him somewhere, and I said, well, did you ever solve that? And he said, yeah, that was solved by changing the oil.
Oh.
And they got an oil that didn't flavor the fish.
They continued to dump it.
I think today they don't dump it in the fjord. I think they now impound it in fact, without a doubt.
I'm sure.
And but then they did that. Mm-hmm. But Olaf spent a lot of summers there, and then until they finally hired him as the research director, and then he left Imperial College and moved back there and stayed until he retired. And nice person. Still get Christmas cards from him. Usually he spends the winter in the Canary Islands or something. Doesn't want to be where it's cold and dark in Norway in the winter. But the thing about what I found interesting about a department there in Imperial College, like this mineral technology part, taught all their own courses. They taught the math. I mean, another just nine or 11 people that made the department. Somebody taught the math. Kitchener taught the chemistry. It's kind of an odd thing that each department was a little school, all of its own. And I don't know whether that goes on today, but they taught I don't think a student took any course outside of that department. Or that's my recollection of what it was like. It seemed very odd. And you know, their degree was, all in British degrees are 3 years. You know, they did a BS degree at the end of 3 years, and they claim that it's very feasible based on their very rigid high school curriculum. You know, start weeding kids out at, I don't know what they call them, levels, I think.
And, A level and O level.
Yeah, and so, you know, in our country we got a chance of recovery later on, but I think in England or Germany, boy, if you're aimed at the Volksschule, that's where you go. And likewise, in England. Anyway, one student there, Brian Ball, graduated as a first degree. And they only give about one per class get a first. Then they have an upper two and a lower two. And I think they will take for PhDs the first and the upper two. And maybe on occasion they may take a lower two, and then they also have a degree they call honors. Mm. And then the bottom of the line just gets the degree. So they really stretch them out into five categories. So one of them, named Brian Ball, got an upper a first, and he came here as a grad student. So that was one thing that came from my stay there. He did his master's PhD with me, very capable person. Went for a little bit, was at Colorado School of Mines, and then quite a few years with Newmont. And incredibly, died at age 42 from melanoma that started on his little toe. God, isn't that pathetic? When you think of melanoma starting on your little toe, and in age 42 died. Terrible. Mm. And very able person. So we were there. I remember going on the field trip during the spring break with the students. We visited coal operations and lead zinc mill in the middle of England somewhere. Near Sheffield was lots of coal. You always hear on TV, the BBC accent, and boy, you get up to around Sheffield, and I remember the engineer there talking about taking the bus to London and a tune of coal.
Hard to understand.
Oh, yeah, that's not that many miles away. And so anyway, I had this, rather, pleasant trip going with the...
Did you ever meet McPherson?
Not then.
No.
You see him as his brother?
Yes.
No, then I knew none of about him until when you did the oral history, or it was done. Then that was, well, later on, just before we left, we traveled a bit around England. I was afraid to rent a car until
yes.
about the end. We went by train a lot. And living in London, we always by buses, some underground, and we took the train here and there. And I remember I did go up to Leeds, visit the University of Leeds, which had a, you know, they have a very significant mining, mineral processing, metallurgy. Spent a couple of days there, went over to Bristol. Remember, we did, when we rented a car, we drove to Stonehenge, and and back then you could walk around and climb around on those big stones that make Stonehenge. Today it's all enclosed in a fence, so you can only look at it from a distance. And we did drive all the way up into Scotland, and one of the high points was walking on Hadrian's Wall, which you know was built around 300 or 400, and to keep the Scots out. And there's places that you can really walk along this, and you can just see the wall go up and over the hills and so on. And to me, that was almost a real high point. And oh, of course, we took the kids to see the Queen every time she rode, like on her birthday or whenever there was a visitor. The Queen rode in her open carriage, and so we were down there with the kids. And sometime in the winter, we went to what's the castle that, where they live?
Buckingham?
No, out near the airport. The Queen, in Buckingham, they just sort of stayed.
Oh. Windsor?
Windsor Castle. So we were there in the winter, and remember the guard had a gray uniform, not the red one that you know about. It had a little shed, a little cubby hole where he stood, and he'd stand in front of one, and then he'd march the other one, click his heel, and stand there. So our son Steve, who was only not yet three, stood in this little cubbyhole guardhouse, and the guard, when he came back, said something to Steve, and Steve came back to us, and I said, "What did he say?" Steve said, "Beat it, kid." They're not supposed to react, right? that was, I think, a great occasion for all of us. Mm-hmm. And the next sabbatical was in Karlsruhe, 1973. And I wanted to go to Karlsruhe because there was an institute, in English really, Institute for Mechanical Processing, and in German, Mechanische Verfahrenstechnik, which is part of the chemical engineering. And this was the Technical University of Karlsruhe under the head leadership in this of Professor Hans Rumpf. And Rumpf was a remarkable person, and in my opinion, he was the leading person worldwide in particle technology. And he had built up this institute that had maybe 200 people working there, and Winslow being like part of the college. And you know, in German universities, when you're a professor, you have an institute. And I used to call them professors with institute and professors without institute. But this, you know, distribution was a big thing, particle sizing, classifications, particle separations. It just, you know, fantastic setup, and with the way Germans pour money into things, it made you feel quite modest. But Rumpf had been I'd seen papers that he'd written, published in Mining Engineering, for a company called Alpine, Alpina, but spelled Alpine, made classifiers, and he was a big expert in that, and at age 47 was hired to come as a professor in Karlsruhe. So here at the age when you often hear that people are winding down, he was starting up, mm-hmm. and built, you know, really amazing amount of very good work. I met him at one of those engineering foundation conferences, but I knew of his efforts. So this is why we wanted to go there. Mm-hmm. And again, I planned this, was on full pay from Berkeley, so I had no commitments, and they supplied me with an office and so on. I guess I had interacted a little bit with Rumpf in between. He had risen also to be the rector of the University of Karlsruhe. And then in Germany is something called the Association of Rectors, in other words, of all universities and colleges. And for 3 years he was the president of the Rectors Association, which meant he was in Bonn. And one time when I visited there, he came, maybe I gave a seminar, I know I did, and then he came and we went out to a marvelous dinner and all that. But he had a big black Mercedes and a driver, you know, because mm-hmm. he'd come from Bonn just to spend some time with me. And
so you were lecturing there at this
just
time?
A seminar. This was before the sabbatical. Because when we were there, he was through being the president of the rector. But he was the first engineer to hold that job. So mm-hmm. that person is very powerful in that that's where the negotiations go with the German legislature, Bundestag, I guess it's called, and the universities, was through this rector's association, which is why he was in, you know, for 3 years in Bonn. Mm. But when we got to 73, that was history. That institute ran with three, they called it kind of a triumvirate, Rumpf at the head, and then Schernert was now a professor, and somebody named Fritz Leffler, a fairly young guy, like Schernert, or even younger than Schernert, a professor. And what I find interesting is, you know, somebody's got a chair here or something, and it's got a big title. But if you're in Germany, the highest professor is called Ordentlicher Professor, ordinary professor. That's the mm-hmm. highest. Extraordinary professor is less. So Schernert and Leffler were, you know, Außerordentlicher Professors and, you know, some professors. And only the ordinary professor could have the institute. Mm. And so the three of them ran this whole operation, let's say, and like you said, at least 200 people.
And this was research and teaching both?
Research, teaching. There were people that would have been the equivalent of lecturers in a British system, or here it could be lecturers too. Mm-hmm. And there may have been three or four of them. The researchers would be a lot of them, a long-term effort working on for a doctor of engineering degree, which might be 5-10 years. The full-time pay, and then a full suite of technicians, and they even had, I now remember, they even had a person full-time running a Xerox machine.
Well.
And I remember one German equivalent of grad student said, you know, he's just a damn Nazi. And I remember chatting with a person quite a bit at one time, and I don't know, he told me he had flown something like 100, 200, 300 air missions. Of course, when you're inside Germany, you know, it might only have been a 15, 20 minute flight over shooting at Russian tanks or something. I remember talking to whoever this guy was about it, but his full-time job was just running the Xerox machine, because this was 73 when life was Xerox a little more complicated, maybe. Mm-hmm. But anyway...
Excuse me, I'm going to have you spell this word for ordinary professor. I couldn't get that.
Ordentliche.
O-R?
O-R-D-E-N-T... L-I-C-H-E.
Okay.
I think I'll check that.
Okay.
And then Ausser, just A-U-S, or two S's, E-R, or S-Z-E-R.
okay.
That's outside of, mm-hmm. outside of ordinary.
All right.
anyway, it's kind of interesting that the higher the rank, just ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, just to illustrate one project they had, which is not mining, but they had a huge project, I think from the Swiss, maybe Germans, grinding chocolate. And you know, the Swiss chocolate is so good because they grind it very, very fine, and much finer than our chocolate is ground. And by grinding in mills and
grinding
the bean, yeah, and I guess they still had it when that project was on. We arrived, but they made candy, and then they would have people taste it. This was a really, when done on small scale, they apparently had virtually a pilot plant scale. But if you ever want to know why some people's chocolate is better than others, it's due to the fineness of the comminution of the coca bean. And
that would be a nice project to work on.
Hey, true enough. And so they had, a large variety of that. We spent some time, when we first got there, Rumpf invited us to dinner, I guess, at the faculty club, and there was a friend of theirs. Can't think of the last name now, but I know there was a math professor named Johannes, and his wife taught languages. And she had a regular teaching role of teaching German to English diplomats. And so we arranged that Peg and I spent an hour or two with her once a week on German. Like I found that her dog understood more German than we did at times. But anyway, our kids were there, and they were then 9, 11, and 13. We put them all in German schools. Lucy had studied German in 8th grade here, planning this ahead. Steve came home in March and said to his mother, "I don't know how to go to school. I don't understand anything." By May, he said, "You know, Mom, I understand everything, and I almost have nerve enough to answer the teacher's questions." Which tells me, you know, this thing about bilingualism, little kids can learn so fast that it's only adults that learn slowly. I know from my own efforts. And anyway, we got back from that dinner. Steve said, the name was Weissman, something like that. Steve said, "Oh, you know, that man was a king, and I said, "Well, why? What makes him a king?" "Well, Professor Rumpf was always calling him Your Highness."
Oh.
His name was Johannes. Steve, call him Your Highness.
Cute.
Anyway, we had a...
Where did you live?
We rented an apartment. In fact, it was the only one we could get, and it had, I think, three bedrooms and a living room, maybe the dining room part of it, kitchen. And it was about 5 miles from the institute. And I walked it once in a while, drove most of the time, and it was the only place that Annalena Schoenert could find to rent to us. And most of the people did not want to rent to Americans. They were very unhappy having bad experience, I guess, renting to military people. Because there was a big American Army base in Karlsruhe. So that's southwestern Germany, right on the Rhine. Heidelberg is 30 miles away, and that was, I think, the headquarters of the U.S. In Army in Germany. And so this one woman, rented the place to us, which was very good, and has an apartment, and the school would have been fairly nearby for our kids. I guess they went different directions because...
Wasn't there a big Army hospital there, a U.S. Army hospital in
Probably, because there was a big village that was Army.
I think there was the Army, U.S. Army.
Yeah. See, we debated whether, you know, where maybe we looked at, sending our kids to, American school, and we decided no. You know, took Peg had the math workbooks, and then the kids were writing in German schools. And,